talk, you know that I'm very strongly sustained the statistical model theory, or as they call it today, these generalized probability theories, are just a branch of Bayesian theory. And so the talk initially I wanted to do is just a derivation of all the features of these generalized probability theories, just from Bayesian theory. But then I realized that you've heard a lot of this stuff during the last 2 weeks because of the FOIL's conference. And then there would be mainly equations, no figures, and that's boring. And then probably I will put this on paper anyway. So instead I'm going to speak about something else, which is something which you probably have met several times in physics or mathematics, but probably not from this point of view. And especially probably not from the geometrical point of view, more from an algebraic point of view. And this is going to be mainly a tutorial with some just a glimpse of ideas of this, where this can lead to. And so we start from the concept of a fine space. And typically it is fine spaces are introduced as vector spaces from which you take away the origin. So what kind of concept define an affine space? We have a parallelism, but there is no absolute length, just as in a vector space. There are no angles defined as in a vector space. And we can define a relative length, but only along the same directions. So we can compare, for example, to lengths along two parallel lines or to areas in two parallel surfaces, but not compare, for example, two lengths along two unparallel lines. And there is no origin in these kind of spaces.
I'm sorry, I have a question. So these are the same shape as affine spaces. Is that what you mean?
Suppose you are walking in a affine space, and first you meet, let's take this. First you meet this shape, okay. Then you walk a little bit more. And later you encounter this shape. Well, you cannot tell if, for you, this is exactly the shape, the same structure, the same shape that you met before.
So there is an affine map.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you were in a, say, in a vector space with an inner product, so you can define the notion of angle, you would immediately say, ah, no, these are perpendicular, these two lines. Here they are not, so it's not the same structure. Instead, in an affine space, they're just, it's the same shape, basically. I suppose all of you have met affine spaces before. So then there is the notion of direction and in an affine space, which is simply, for example, a one-dimensional direction is just a line. Actually, it's not a precise line, a particular line, but all the family of all lines parallel to that line. So to speak, we choose a line, but we don't choose where to position it in the space. So these are three different directions. But there are also multidimensional directions. For example, a two-dimensional direction is just a plane, or more precisely, a family of parallel planes. So you choose a plane, but you are not choosing where to place it in the affine space. Once we have a direction, we can consider the set of all directions parallel to the initial one. For example, if you consider in a three-dimensional space, a fine space, a line, the family of all lines parallel to this one are parameterized by two parameters, right? So the complement of this direction is a two-dimensional space, a fine space, actually. And there is an isomorphism between this space of lines with, say, for example, a plane crossing the line. Because if I choose a plane that crosses the line, I can pick up a point on this plane, and that immediately identify a line parallel to the initial one. And the same, for example, in a three-dimensional affine space, for if I choose a two-dimensional direction, then the family of this direction is just one parameter family, so I have a one-dimensional affine space, and I can make an isomorphism between this complement space with a line crossing the original plane. These concepts are important for what follows. So in an affine space, just as in a vector space, we can define vectors. The only difference is that in a vector space, if you represent vectors as arrows, all the arrows have a common origin, the origin of the vector space. In an affine space, they can be placed wherever because there is no origin. And typically in school, they present you as a vector as something which has a direction, in this case, a one-dimensional direction, a magnitude, so we choose a length in that direction, and an orientation. We say if it goes in this, this orientation or the other orientation. And so if we try to generalize now this concept, for example, instead of just using a one-dimensional direction, we could choose an n-dimensional direction. And also the magnitude. Here the magnitude is chosen on the direction itself. But we could choose a magnitude on the complementary space to this. And also the orientation. Here we have chosen an orientation on this direction itself. But we could choose an orientation on the complementary space to this direction, which in this case, the complementary space is a plane. What do we obtain by doing this generalization? Let's take the one-dimensional case. So we choose a one-dimensional direction. Now, we can choose a magnitude on the direction itself or on the complementary space. If we choose a magnitude on the direction itself, we have this, just a length. If we consider now the complementary space, which is a plane, choosing a magnitude on a plane means choosing an area. The important point is it doesn't matter what kind of shape this area has. You can compare areas with different shapes. So you can say if they are equal or if one is double the other and so on. So the shape doesn't matter. So in the plane, in a plane that crosses this direction, we can choose an area. And that immediately selects all the lines that pass through the border of this area. So they give me a sort of tube, or in this case, a sort of parallel pivot. And of this is infinite in length. Are you following up to this point? Okay. Then we must choose a magnitude. Let's come back here. We can choose a magnitude in the direction itself, and then we have a vector. But we can choose a magnitude in the complementary space. So in this case, this is for three-dimensional affine space. We are choosing a circulation sense in a plane that crosses this vector. Notice that it doesn't matter how I choose the plane. The only thing that matters is that it crosses the vector. So it doesn't contain the vector. And in this case, instead, I can choose an orientation along this direction, and that's here we are. Or again, an orientation in the complementary space. So in this case, I have a circulation around this tube. It's quite intuitive. Actually, these kind of differences were already noted by Maxwell. If you read the book in his electromagnetism, he makes a difference between two kind of vectors. One he calls forces, which are characterized by magnitudes, one-dimensional magnitudes, and other which he calls fluxes, which are characterized by two-dimensional magnitudes, so areas in this case, cross-sections. This was the one-dimensional, so we started from a one-dimensional direction. Let's start from a two-dimensional direction, so a plane. Let's choose a magnitude. If you choose the magnitude on the plane, then we are choosing just an area on the plane. Again, the shape doesn't matter. Or we can choose a magnitude on the complementary space to this direction. In this case, the complementary space is just a line that crosses the direction. If on this line I choose a magnitude, so I consider a line here, I choose a magnitude. And so I choose a sort of, so to speak, a segment. So this segment will be selected by two parallel planes like this, you see here. In reality, you can imagine an infinite sequence of these planes, equally spaced between with one another. Then choosing the orientation. In the first case, I can choose an inner orientation, so to speak, so in the same direction. And then in the end, I have just an area with a circulation sense. Or I can choose an orientation in the complementary space, and then I have an area with a sense of crossing. I can cross the area from this side to this side, or from this side to this side. And in this case, again, so I have the two parallel planes, and I can choose a crossing directions across the planes, or a circulation sense in each one of the planes. Let's consider now the zero-dimensional case. A zero-dimensional direction is just a point. If I choose a magnitude on the point, I'm simply giving a number associated to the point. So I have a positive number. Or, so what is the complementary space to a point? It's just the whole three-dimensional space. So choosing a magnitude on a three-dimensional space would be choosing a small volume. Again, the shape, it doesn't matter. I could choose a ball here with the same value. Let's choose the orientation. Here I can choose an inner orientation, but inner orientation for a number is a plus or minus, simply. So I'm associating to this number a real number. So it can be positive or negative. Or I can associate an orientation of the complementary space. The complementary space is a three-dimensional. So what I'm choosing is a skew sense, the typical, the standard one chosen, they speak about in English, in physics courses is the rule of your right hand. So first this, then first this finger, then the thumb. And this gives you a skew sense. And there are exactly two skew senses, like here. So in this case, I'm associating to a point a positive number and a skew sense of the space around it. So this is a scalar, basically. This is not a scalar. It's called an oriented scalar. If I choose numbers, negative numbers here, corresponds to just changing the skew sense in front of this number. Going back instead to the volume case, I can associate an inner orientation, which is inner means associated to the point, and then it's just a plus or minus associated to this volume. Or I can associate an outer orientation, and again, that's a skew sense. So I'm associating a skew sense inside this small volume. And finally, the three-dimensional case. And you understand, the three-dimensional case, the direction is just the whole space, and the complement will be a point. So a magnitude in the whole space will just be a small region with a given value. And there, I can choose two orientations. You see, basically, in this case, I obtain exactly what I obtained before, but the two roles are inverted. So there is a sort of dualism between the maximum dimensional case and the zero dimensional case of these directions. So now there is some terminology about this kind of geometrical objects. So if you consider the magnitude, if the magnitude is on the same space as the direction, you call this a vector. If the magnitude is on the complementary space, you call this a form. And probably you have seen this. In this case, you know that an affine form, one form, is usually presented as two parallel planes. And then this is the magnitude, this is the distance between the planes. So when the magnitude is on the complement, we call that a form, or a covector sometimes it's called. And so the dimension of the space in which we have chosen the magnitude tells you if you're speaking about a one vector, a b vector, or a one form, a two form. For example, we speak about that later. And so this probably is something you have met very often in differential geometry. Very seldom, instead, one makes this difference. Even books like, David Choquet-Bruha book on differential manifolds and theoretical physics, which is a sort of Bible of differential geometry. They speak very, very quickly about this. And so if we choose the orientation on the same space as the direction, we call that vector or that form straight. The original terminology due to the RAM was even. Instead, if we choose the orientation on the complement, then we call it twisted. The original name was odd. But as you understand, if I speak on a, for example, on an odd form, maybe you may think of one form. Instead, I come in a two form, which has a twisted orientation. So twisted and straight are better terms. Not completely satisfying, but they are better than even an odd. So here is the whole map. So
polar and axial.
Yeah, this, let's see. There is actually, it doesn't correspond exactly to straight and twisted, because basically a polar vector, the polar axial difference makes at the same time a difference between twisted and straight, and a difference between the complementary dimensionalities, between, for example, 1 and 2, or 0 and 3, or, for example, 1 and 3 in 4 dimensions.
I guess there's different conventions.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah. But that's a, also pseudo vector sometimes.
Also pseudo.
Yeah, also, that's another name. So this is what normally is called just a vector. But as you see, there is a whole family of this. This is what normally is called a scalar. So these are straight vectors. This is just a scalar, a vector, and then an area with an inner orientation, and it's called usually a B vector. Or a volume with an inner orientation, a skew sense, and that's a tree vector. Forms, you probably have met many times the normal one forms, which are straight. And this is a two form, which is just a tube with an circulation around. Note a three form in three dimensions is basically exactly like a straight three vector. And now the twisted objects are interesting. For example, a twisted vector, it doesn't have an orientation on the line, it's around. For example, so this is, for example, the vector which we mean when we speak about angular momentum. You know the strange relation with angular momentum. You say if a body is rotating, for example, like this, then you associate with a vector such that, let's see, how is that? The point of the vector followed by the circulation sense given by the two fingers is like the sequence of fingers in your right hand. But as you see, the natural geometrical object to represent this is a twisted vector. So you have a magnitude which represents the angular velocity, but the orientation immediately gives you the sense of rotation of your object. Notice indeed that to associate this with an angular velocity, you need an orientation in your outer space. Not a volume element. But you need an orientation on the outer space. Here, you don't need an orientation on the outer space. You could live in, for example, in a Möbius strip, and you could use this concept anyway. And so a twisted B vector is an area, but as you see, it's you're choosing a way into which to cross the area, not a sense in which you walk inside the area. And with these objects, just as we add the multiply vectors by scalars, we can do all these kind of operations for these objects as well. For example, here you see the sum of two twisted vectors. So you join them together in such a way that the circulation sense in the line which is formed by the two is the same. So for example, if I would join these up here instead, I would obtain something which circulates like this. So it goes out and in, and then suddenly it changes circulation, so it doesn't work. If I join this down here instead, then I have this outer circulation, and then it keeps on circulating that way. And then I just draw the line from the two and the three end points. And this line will have the same, so if I have this circulation here, I just do the same in this line. So this is the result of the sum of these two vectors. And I can also sum, for example, forms. This is more complicated. So you consider the intersections of these four planes. So this plane is associated to the first form and this to the second form. And so you see I have a sense in which I'm crossing these planes. So this is the first plane and this is the second one. I consider the intersection of the first plane of the first form with the first plane of the second form. And in this case, I get this line, a line here. If I overlap them, I obtain a line here. Then I consider two other intersections. The one of the second plane of the first form with the first plane of the second form. And I have this line here. And then of the first plane of the first form and the second plane of the second form. And obtain this line here. From the last two lines, since they are parallel because of geometrical reasons, I can choose a plane which goes through them. And then I can choose a plane parallel to this one, which goes across, which contains the original line, which we found. So I obtain these two planes. And I can also very intuitively associate an orientation on their complement. And that's the sum of these two forms. I can do these operations. I won't speak about multiplying and by a scalar because that's intuitive. So you just change the distances. But you can do this kind of operation with all these geometrical objects which you have seen. And of course, what you know is that they can be paired with each other. So I can pair a form and a vector of the same dimension, and I get a scalar. In this case, I'm pairing a straight object with a straight object. And you know how it works. So I move the vector until its best point lies on this plane. And then I count how many planes would it take from this distance to cover the whole vector. In this case, for example, the length of the vector is like twice. I would need twice this form to cover the vector. So the result of this operation is just a scalar. And since the orientations are the same, the scalar will be positive. Consider this a twisted one form. So I do exactly the same procedure. So I apply this to this. So I'm checking, I compare this length with the length selected by these two planes along this direction. And here, for example, I see that the total length is more or less twice and a half times the one of the distances, the distance between the two forms. Compare the so I get 2.5. Compare the orientations, and you see that one is going here, and the other is going the other direction. So the result will be a negative scalar because the orientation don't match; they are opposite. And you see the same operation with a two-form. So a two-form is just like a cookie cutter. So it selects an area, and I can select this area on this two vector. In this case, since the radius here looks like it's double this, so the result will be 4. And since the orientations don't match, the result will be negative, so -4. And the same for the twisted two forms. Notice how, maybe we will speak about that later. Notice how, basically here, from a physical point of view, it's like I'm considering a surface, and I consider a flux of something across the surface. So this was just a single affine space. Now we can consider a differential manifold. And indeed, I shouldn't have drawn these lines because this looks like a vector space. So consider instead a generic differential form. So to each tangent space, I can associate a vector and or a form. And so for each tangent space, for each point and in each tangent space, I have a vector or a form. And so this defines a vector field or a differential form field. And this is an example of a straight vector field and on a straight one-form field. In some cases, from these fields, I can sort of choose a submanifold inside my differential manifold such that the vectors of the field are tangent to the submanifold. I can always do it locally for a vector field, for example. And but that's not always the case. For example, it's not always possible to do that for a one form. And now, why are all these kind of objects important? And what has been the first application? It's just for the theory of integration in general differential manifolds. So, for example, I can integrate a one form is an object that I can integrate on a one-dimensional submanifold. On the one-dimensional submanifold, I have defined a vector field, one-dimensional vector field. So given that I have a differential form defined on the whole space, for each point of the vector of the submanifold, I can just apply the form to the local vector, tangent vector, and then just sum up the whole result. It's a sort of a Riemann procedure. I can go over and I go the Lebesgue way. Anyway, in the end, what I obtain is a scalar. And this is for a integration of a one-dimensional submanifold. And of course, I can integrate also on a two-dimensional submanifold. And in this case, I must integrate to two forms. So a two-form in a three-dimensional differential manifold can be represented by a sequence of cubes. So notice these are not any longer straight tubes. They can bend, they can change in cross-section because it's a form field. It's not just one form. And so the number of tubes crossing my surface is giving me the integral of the quantity associated to these tubes. The importance of the difference between straight and twisted differential forms is that, for example, in this case, you see the surface has an outer orientation. So I'm not choosing a circulation sense inside the surface. So if you consider a differential manifold like the Mobius strip, you know it's non-orientable. So if I were to say I want to calculate its area, how much is this surface? The normal theory of integration along on a surface, you assume that you have a surface and you have a circulation on the surface, because they never use twisted forms. They assume that there is a volume element in your differential manifold so that you can pair. Instead of using a straight twisted form, you can use the corresponding straight form. But in some manifolds, like the Mobius strip, you cannot do this because there is not a volume element definable, different from zero in each point. But strange enough, you can't speak about the surface of a Mobius strip anyway. So how does that come about? It's because a surface, usually, when you calculate an area, is not associated with a straight B vector, which is something given by a surface like this with a circulation. You're integrating on a twisted B vector, so something which has a crossing direction from one side to the other. And also, an important thing about all these concepts is that none of them involves a metric. Up to now, we are just talking about lines and surfaces, and we can compare areas, but only on parallel lines. So only affine concepts. There is no mention of a metric. So this was the geometrical point of view, and you have met all these kind of objects algebraically, like typically in differential forms, general relativity as a vector, a bivector, a form, a two-form. And the twisted form, you never met them. And we can represent this way when this is a sort of twisting operator which is introduced by Burke. I don't know, what's the pronunciation? Burke. He's famous for some research in general relativity, this guy. And he has done a lot of research on this, the application to electromagnetic theory of this kind of geometrical objects. And so now comes the nice point, is that these objects are very strong, are immediately associated to our physical intuition. For example, consider a representation of matter, of mass, or even of charge. intuitively, physically speaking, is something which you associate to a three-dimensional region of space, bounded. In the limit, you can choose just a point. And you can sort of pick a point, pick this point, mark it, and follow it as it moves around. Or if it is a region, maybe this region will change shapes and shrink and dilate. But you can follow it around. So it has a sort of an identity and doesn't disappear. There's a conservation of mass or of charge. Also, if you consider a three-dimensional region, a volume, and there is matter inside this volume, you can count how many of these balls or these boxes are inside this three-dimensional region. So it's telling you how much matter or mass or charge there is inside the volume. Or if you consider a two-dimensional surface in a given interval of time, you can count how many of these balls or boxes are crossing the surface in the given amount of time. And again, it's giving you the flux of the mass or of the charge across the surface. So the main point is that the identity, so it's something that you can point to and follow it as it moves around. And you see this, from a space-time point of view, then it means that we are representing this kind of physical properties by a twisted tree form. So this is a sort of three-dimensional space-time analog of the four-dimensional case. So we live in these surfaces, which here are two-dimensional, but in our case are three-dimensional. So a twisted tree form in space-time, in the three-dimensional analog, is just a two-form. So it is given by tubes. These tubes are never-ending, and they can change in a cross-section and shape. So from a three-dimensional perspective, what we see, what this observer sees, is just small circles moving around in this two-dimensional space and maybe changing shape. From our point of view, what we will see is just exactly this kind of small regions of three-dimensional regions moving around and changing shape. And the conservation, how is it expressed? And so if we count how many balls are in an initial three-dimensional region, and then count how many balls or boxes are entering the two-dimensional surface that defines the three-dimensional region, and subtract the balls that exit from the same surface, and then subtract the balls that finally are left in the final three-dimensional region at the end of a given interval of time, then all this sum will be zero. It's, again, conservation of mass or of charge. And it's, again, due to the fact that these lines never end. So if this tube never ends. So if one tube is entering from somewhere, it must come out. And what we are saying is that this tree form is closed. And you usually express it like, let's see. You write something like this. That's the closure property. So you're applying the differential operator to forms. But it has this precise geometrical meaning. Now consider the Faraday tensor for the electromagnetic field. A typical nice presentation is the one in Meissner, Thorne, and Wheeler book, Gravitation. So it is a two-form. It's a straight two-form in space-time. From the three-dimensional space-time analog, then it's a family of surfaces that can change shape and change the distances between them. What you do with this, in this case, with these planes, is that you consider a two-dimensional surface with an inner orientation. You count how many of these cross cuts this two-dimensional surface in the three-dimensional analog. From our space-time point of view, So a two-form in space-time is a sort of hypersurfaces. So they are things with the three dimensions. And a three-dimensional observer, so us, sees them as tubes moving around in 3D space, three-dimensional space. And they may be, again, chain shape or so also cross-section. So what do these tubes, what properties do these tubes satisfy in the case of the Faraday tensor? This is...
Are you sure that there's a geometrical interpretation in four dimensions?
We speak about, There is a...
There's an issue of sums of...
Exactly. I will speak about it. And... so the two Maxwell's equations, the one said the divergence of the B field is zero, and the derivative in time of the, what was it, of the B field plus or minus the curl of the E field is equal to zero. It's just saying this fact about these tubes. So choose a two-dimensional surface. In our case, we have a two-dimensional surface. Actually, I can show it's exactly what's happening in this picture in our case, but anyway. So these tubes never end. So there will be some tubes intersecting this two-dimensional surface. Count them. As time evolves, these tubes move around, and some of them will be suddenly entering into this two-dimensional surface, so they will be crossing the edges, the contour of the surface. And subtract those tubes instead that are going out of the surface, so they don't cross the surface anymore. And then finally, subtract the tubes that are, in the end, still crossing the surface. This sum must be zero. And that's the contact, the geometrical contact of the two Maxwell's equations, the one which don't mention a charge or a current. And this property is simply, again, the fact that these two forms is closed, and typically in general relativity, so you write this like this. And that's this contains the two of the Maxwell's equations. Now, as Sorkin was saying, is that there is a fact here. It's that in four dimensions, there is no direct geometric representation of a two-form. It comes about because, let's see. So in four dimensions, a generic two-form can be written as something like this. Now, a term like this, I can give a geometric interpretation like a hypertube. But I don't have a geometric interpretation of the sum. So I cannot geometrically sum these tubes. So I can represent this object just by giving you the list of all tubes and that they are summed together. Not only this, there is an additional complication. This decomposition is not unique. So I could choose different tubes and tell you the form, the final form, is the sum of these other tubes. And there is no choice which is preferred than another one. So there is no standard choice. So this would seem to fail. But there is another theory that says that the projection of this two-form on a three-dimensional slice of my four-dimensional space-time gives me a tube, and that's a unique tube. So independently how I decompose this, my three-dimensional representation is exactly the same. It's a sort of tube. And this seems to be telling also something about this, the difference between four dimensions and three dimensions. It's that you may have some, I find it quite interesting, the fact that in three dimensions anyway, you have a unique geometric representation. There can be some physical meaning behind it. So now consider again that for the format there, we started from this prerequisite, which is features of when we think about mass or matter. And then we gave to them just a geometric representation. And we find the perfect object to represent matter is a twisted three-form. Now do the opposite here. So you have these properties. what physical meaning do they have? So we can count how many cubes intersect our two-dimensional surface. And we can count how many cubes cross or pass through an edge of this two-dimensional surface. This means that if we have an electromagnetic field, I can choose a cube representing this field. And if I let it evolve, I can tell you this cube that was here now or here before is exactly the same cube that is here. The cube that was here before is exactly the same cube that is there now. So I can follow these cubes. They have a sort of identity. The important point here is that I cannot follow sections of the tube. So I can tell you this tube is exactly the same tube that was here before. Fine. But I cannot tell you, for example, this section here of the tube, this part here of the tube, is the same one as the one that was here before. So you have an identification of the whole tube or line in the limit, but not of points or sections of the tube along the line. So here we have a sort of generalization of the notion of particle. So a particle, mass, matter, is something which has a point-like and you can follow it around. It has an identity. For the case of the electromagnetic field, we have a sort of generalized form of something which has an identity. But these kind of objects are one-dimensional, and their identity is one-dimensional. So you cannot choose a sub-identity, which is zero-dimensional, so points along the line. And that's okay. So what use can we have about this? Maybe some pedagogical... I found very difficult to visualize the first time when I started studying electromagnetic fields. They try to make you understand what a field is, and then you start drawing little arrows in space, and you say, you can combine these arrows, there are the fields, lines, and so on. But it's not the same intuition as a notion of particle, of mass, of matter. And also, they never tell you, at one time you can have a given configuration of these arrows, at a later time these arrows are changed, but you cannot say that something has moved from here to there. Maybe about energy, you can speak about energy in that way, maybe. So they have some pedagogical use. You could speak of an electromagnetic field just as this kind of entity, one-dimensional entity that moves around. Can we have any more use of this? And actually,
isn't this how people often used to teach lines of force, magnetic lines of force, they move around?
Yeah. Actually, these are not the lines of force.
Well, there's something like this.
Yeah, there is the article by Faraday, very famous, about the lines of force. But the lines of force of Faraday, and the one which you usually draw, they are not the cubes. So you cannot follow a line of force. You cannot say this line of force here is the same that later is the one here. These tubes are not the same as line of force. They are more like equipotential surfaces. So they sort of cross the line of forces. It's not the same object, geometrical object, as the line of forces, lines of force of that you use in school. So it's not exactly the same thing.
So these are not lines of magnetic field?
Let's see. For the electric field, they are not the line of force. But for the magnetic field, they are. Yeah, I think so. For example, if you consider, say, the electric field between two parallel plates. Typically, the line of forces are like this, right? But in this case, the tubes corresponding to this field are degenerate tubes, which have they got to have an infinite cross-section. So there's something like this. Let's see. Something like this. So it's a tube which is getting an infinite. So one of the directional. So a tube, the cross section is identified by two dimensions. One of the two directions, is getting an infinite in width. So the tube is almost becoming a sheet, so to speak. Like a plane. And that's the representation of the tube for this case of a constant electric field between two plates. So these kind of tubes are not the same as the lines of force in this case. So can we do more about this? And actually, there was some interesting ways of thinking about this way about the electromagnetic field. The first to speak about this was Page. I don't know how to pronounce this. How do you pronounce it? Lee Page. He has a nice introduction to theoretical physics book for this week. And he speaks he sort of reinterprets the momentum of an electromagnetic field as a sort of force which is acting on the field. You usually speak about a force on a charge caused by the field. In this case, it's a force on the field caused by the charge. And this was elaborated many years later, in 2007, by Erikson. It's a guy who has done a lot of work in partially mathematician, partially physicist, a lot of work in electromagnetism. And he has this very nice article in which he's just exploring this possibility of or introducing the idea of a force that applies to an electromagnetic field. And so, as he writes, the idea that electromagnetic fields can sustain forces. So this will change the dynamics. Usually, the dynamics between electromagnetic field and a charge is that there is a connection between the two via Maxwell's equation. And then we have the Lorentz force, which is a force that the charge sustains due to the field. In this case, instead, the idea is to have a mutual force. It's the charge is acting on a force on the field, and the field is acting with a force on the charge. And it leads to it leads to consequences, maybe not for just the usual electromagnetic electrodynamics in vacuum, but when you have electrodynamics in materials, then it leads to some nice consequences of sort of picks up with some interpretations in respect to other interpretations. And mathematically, what does this mean? Because it's clear what does mean to a force as something which you are applying for a point. Or you integrate it and then you're applying it to a volume. But how can you, what does it mean to apply a force to a line? Because remember, in this line, you cannot select a point as an individual. It's the line which is a unique individual. So you cannot just integrate the force along each point on the line. So mathematically, what this would mean is that instead of representing force as a form value to form, this is the general notion of force in continuum mechanics, where it includes the notion, for example, of stress. So the force that a material or a piece of mass exert on another piece of mass across the surface. So you have a two form because you, in the end, you integrate across the surface. And then it's a form value because the force is something that you integrate along a line and that gives you work. So in this case, since you would have to apply this to a line, it seems that the right concept to choose would be a form value three form. In the end, it's something that you integrate on a line and gives you work anyway. And there are other applications of this kind of geometrical objects, and especially seeing the electromagnetic field in this kind of way. I can mention one in which there is some research going on now. And it is this. It's an approach first presented by people like, Kotler. in the 20s. And then there is also Van Danzig. And then and in recent days is held. You probably know this guy because he made a lot of studies about general relativity with torsion. So energy, momentum, stress tensor, which is asymmetric. But he's done a lot of studies about this as well. And so what they do, also Abraham, no, Bateman, before the 1920s, they reformulate the electromagnetic field equations like this. So you have a form, a twisted tree form, which represent the charge and current. It's the one we spoke about when speaking about mass. It's exactly the same kind of object. And you have the equation that this form must be closed, conservation of charge. Then you have a theorem in differential geometry that says, the theory of differential forms that says that if a form is closed, then you can find a form, and let's call it M. So let's write like this. It is a two-form, such that this form one is the differential of the four, these two forms. If you do it for the electromagnetic field, so when you decompose it in three dimensions plus one dimension, here you have the charge density and the current. The decomposition of this form here instead gives you the H, or let's say the D, and H fields. And this equation is just two of those Maxwell's equations. The one that relates the divergence of D to the charge, and the one that relates the curl of D, the time derivative of H, and the time derivative of the current. On the other hand, you have here a two-form, which is the Faraday two-form. And this basic, when you decompose it in three plus one dimensions, what you get is the fields E and B. And again, you have the laws of conservation of magnetic flux. And this gives you the other two of Maxwell's equations. So you remember, you have four Maxwell's equations. And they are, at this point, not related to one another. They're speaking about two very different kinds of geometrical objects and physical objects. If you want a relation between the two, so suppose you want a connection between these two kind of objects. How can you connect them? Think just in geometrical terms. Here you have a two form, and of course, since it's closed, you can have a form such that one form A, and this is the vector potential, such that the differential of this form gives you the Faraday tensor. That's known. So you want a connection between these two kind of objects. How can you do? Here you have a two-form, and here also you have a two-form, which is this M. However, this form is straight, and this form is twisted. Suppose you want this, then. You want some kind of function that applied to these two forms gives you the other form. So this kind of geometric function, you give to it a two form which is straight, and it gives to you a two form which is twisted. You can ask other nice properties. For example, you can want to have linearity, because here I can define a sum for this form and a sum for this one. and a couple of other properties, linearity. So you look for the simplest such geometrical object. So you start from this framework. You define just this geometrical object. Notice there is no metric here. And this one, they're just topological kind of objects. And then you ask for a connection between the two, which is the simplest possible. You obtain, and this is mainly the work of Hell, that this operator is associated to what you call hedge duality, the star operator. And what's the notable feature here is that it gives you a conformal structure. So starting from these two geometrical objects and asking for a connection between them, it is the easiest possible. What you derive is the whole structure of light cones in your space-time. Notice there is no metric. And we had no causal structure to start with. So this is a very, very remarkable kind of approach. If you look at the standard one, for example, the one in Meissner, Thorne, and Wheeler, what they do is they start in a metric space. So they have already this kind of operator already available. So what they do is they start from this, they go to this, then they use the metric to define this, and from this they define the charge. So in their approach, the charge is a derived object. You start from this and from a metric. From this approach, the charge is primary, because you can speak about charge even if you don't have a metric. It's just counting. Charge is inside a surface, so you don't need a metric to do that. And you derive instead a conformal structure from the simplest relation between the two. And that's a really nice result. And of course, you don't get the whole metric. But you get, in a way, it's natural because you know that Maxwell's equation in vacuum, they are invariant for conformal transformation. So that's what you're getting. And so this is something I was doing research on. The other thing I was doing research on instead is trying to put this approach for GR. Here, you would have the role of mass, so a stress energy momentum tensor. And here, something which represents metric or curvature and so on. The first problem here is that in GR case, you know that the stress energy momentum tensor is not a form. It's a tensor, it's symmetric, it's absolutely not a form. And a nice feature of this is that you can represent it instead. There is some work done by a guy named Segev. Again, and, someone working in continuum mechanics. You can represent a stress energy momentum tensor as a map from a tree form, like this, to another tree form. The physical meaning would be, if you give me a distribution of charge to the stress energy momentum or the analog geometrical object, I can give you the energy associated to that. And anyway, so what I wanted to say with these two last examples is that there can be some nice application about all this kind of geometrical structure. And they have also a pedagogical value. And then if you are interested in seeing more of this, and you can see this reference, you can ask me and I can tell you exactly where they are. There is a nice book by Chalten, Tensor Analysis for Physicists, from the 50s. He already spoke about it. It was written by a mathematician, but this is very physical pictures. And the notation is very old. Indices everywhere, so not just this little geometrical representation. But there are some works around which speaks about this. And that's it.
I'm curious whether the idea you expressed about trying to represent classical electromagnetic theory in terms of these degrees of freedom which are your tubes. Would that provide an avenue towards having a Hamiltonian formulation of that theory, and then possibly getting QED by a sort of canonical quantization approach.
Wow, that's a standard between. No, never thought about it, but that's amazing.
If you have a force that's a three form, then presumably you could introduce a momentum.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It would be that three form, and then you could have some sort of canonical structure.
Yeah, sounds like a nice idea. Actually. There is something about quantization that they have been doing is that you know that from a classical point of view, charge is quantized. It means that when you integrate, a physical law is that you must obtain an integer number when you integrate this form on a three-dimensional value. That's the quantization of charge. So charge comes in multiples of E. You cannot, inside a surface, you cannot have something which is not a multiple of E in terms of charge, right?
Why not? Can I just have any old charge density in a volume?
One more time.
That seems to me not part of classical electromagnetism, but an extra
It's not part of classical electromagnetism. But when you speak of quantization of charge, you do it before, for example, teaching quantum mechanics. It's just a fact that this charge comes in particles, associated to particles, and they have a multiple of each other. Actually, you could do the same here. You have a two-form. You can give a physical postulate. The integral of these two forms on a two-surface must always give you a quantized number. There is some relation between them. So this is a classic approach on which, on top, you are adding this sort of quantization condition. Actually, this leads you to the Hall effect. So you have a unit of magnetic flux. It's already here. So you don't need to go to the full quantum theory, but you need to do just something like you did in classical electromagnetism. You have a classical notion of charge, and you just say, but charge in nature is quantized. And here as well, electromagnetic flux is quantized. Yeah, I don't know. This has not been explored in full, the consequences which you can have of this quantization, classical quantization of the electromagnetic flux. That was something I would be interested in looking more about, but at the moment I have. That's not made much connection, however, with the Hamiltonian idea. That's very nice.
Just a comment.
The
new statement that you said because these two terms have a physical meaning, that kind of idea is one of the origins of string theory. And these are strings. There's some paper by Dirac, I think, where he talks about maybe we could think of a line of force as a physical object, and at its ends would be charged particles. And I think that's often cited as one of the precursors that historically led to string theory.
Nice.
Modern string
theory. I do know about.
Any other question? I have a naive question. So what you presented reminded me of electromagnetism courses at the university. And I remember there was this thing that in electromagnetism one says that the action-reaction principle doesn't hold anymore because the forces are not parallel. Is this formalism a way to kind of recover this fact if you think of those forces as forces are acting on
tubes? I haven't thought about it. So that's a nice idea. A lot of nice ideas.
I think the answer should be yes. Because basically you're just taking into account the stress energy of the electromagnetic field in some, I don't know, some pictorial form or something.
Yeah. The problem is going from classical mechanics, sort of Galilean invariant, to four-dimensional space-time, where you introduce a four-force. Actually, you don't speak any longer about four-forces, you just use four-momentum. So this is a sort of clash of formalism as well, yes. Yeah. One must take into account. That's another.
Okay. I have another comment. You said that the Faraday tensor was a, straight, or a polar kind of.
Yeah.
The untwisting kind of tension.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, this depends, it's not entirely clear. It depends on how you realize reflection physically, right? So
Yeah.
So two possibilities are P, what the aberration called P and the aberration called CP. And they differ by C, which is the change in charge, and that would flip the sign of F relative, not including C.
That's true about the Maxwell sensor. But notice, because here it is not related to charge. It's completely independent of charge. It's a sort of object existing by itself from this point of view. So you just consider P, but C has no effect on it. It has effect on M, the Maxwell sensor.
I'm just saying that's your choice. But there might be physical reasons for making a different choice.
So you see, you meaning represent this as a Fisset sensor instead.
Yes.
Okay. Because the thing
is, CP is a more near the existing symmetry than just P. P is very badly broken. CP, as far as we know, exists. It's not even clear that P exists as an operator. CP does exist.
Oh, I see what you mean.
As an operator.
Can be. It has. I think the fact is straight has a physical meaning about speaking the potential difference along a line. That's directly connected.
Well, I think the physical meaning of the reflection would only really show up if you had a topologically non-trivial space time, and if there were loops in the space time that would allow you to carry something around the loop in reverse orientation.
I see.
If that happens, you could see whether F behaved as what you call a straight tensor or an axial tensor or a twisted tensor. Or it might happen that it can behave in two different ways, and that was a possibility that was pointed out by Ali Lufkin a long time ago. So it might be neither straight nor twisted, depending on the way it was entangled up with a particular topological feature.
I see.
But it might be that it always is either straight or twisted in this setting in which the reflection really has a physical meaning.
I see. I will ask you references about it.
Okay. There are no more questions. Thanks, Luca, again.